Welcome to the 126th episode of Reverse Sweat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
Happy 35th birthday to Wahab Riaz. The Pakistani fast bowler is waiting for a slightly unusual birthday present today, a negative coronavirus test that will mean he's allowed to join Pakistan's tour of England.
And in this virus-free edition of Reverse Sweat Radio, we are going to be talking about some of the things that have caught our eye over the last few weeks, some of the ways that we've been keeping ourselves entertained during this period of lockdown. If Reverse Sweat Radio is one of the ways that you've been keeping yourself entertained, then please do hop over onto iTunes and leave us a review. Maybe just click on that old five-star rating. It's the best way for other people to find out about what we do. If you hate what we do, as we always say, please don't leave us a review. Anyway, moving on. We've also got a feature coming up on a cricket painting from the 1930s. Andy's going to be talking about that. And we've also been reading the new book by one of our favourite authors, I think it's fair to say, Duncan Hamilton. Andy, how have you been entertaining yourselves in this kind of early days of the cricket season without any cricket to watch?
Well, the broadcasters have responded to the decimation of the sports schedule by a sort of torrent of archive footage. And I mentioned last time that I'd been a little bit hesitant at first to engage, but that I'd quite got into the old TMS commentary. So inspired by that, I watched the highlights of the 1984 West Indies England Test at Lord's, which is one of a series of classic Wisden Trophy games that the BBC are putting on, partly as a build-up to the return of Test cricket next month. And I'm so glad I did. From a sort of, I guess, nostalgia for a period I wasn't around for, it's wonderful. The Lords of 1984 is such a different world. You have kind of boys regularly wandering onto the outfield to fetch the ball. It's all a bit less, you know, corporate and slick. And it's just the ground is almost unrecognisable. I mean, it's extraordinary. The sort of, it looks more like a kind of typical county ground than the major slick venue it is today. The cricket's fabulous. You've got Botham's 8-4, Gordon Greenidge's just astonishing double 100. And it did make me wonder, actually, whether sometimes we wouldn't be better off kind of delving into the archives and watching some of these old classics than always necessarily obsessing about kind of keeping up to date with the very latest cricket.
And perhaps it's actually one of the things that we will take as a positive out of this experience is that so often cricket broadcasters hold their archives close to their chest. They don't want to release them because, you know, having the archive is having power in some way. But suddenly this whole situation has meant that broadcasters have had to just go, here we go, here is the archive material, let's let it go. We've talked in the past about Rob Alinda and the work that he's done to get some of the archives out there. And I feel like slightly the genie's out of the bottle in a way. You know, there's no going back from this idea that cricket from the past should be available freely on tap. And as you say, it's such a beautiful thing to be able to actually watch that.
Yeah, and I'm not enough of an expert, and actually maybe it would be a fun thing for us to dig into at some point, but I'm not enough an expert about all the economics and all the rights around these things. But it would seem to me that if you did have a really good quality streaming service, I'm sure people would subscribe and would pay. You know, if you had access to kind of, you know, hundreds of hours of great old footage and it was kind of well presented and well maintained, you know, I think people would be happy to access it. I think the real tragedy in a lot of these cases, and this is why the work of Rob Alinda has been so important, is that this stuff is just unloved. It's kind of sitting there unwatched. One thing I should say the BBC did rather geniusly is they also preserved and showed quite a lot of Richie Beno, who from the original highlights programme when it was first done, rather than over sort of doing it themselves, they used a lot of that original footage, which I thought was a rather neat twist.
Yeah, I think that YouTube is doing a lot of this work anyway, though, because YouTube is actually a commercial platform that gives money back to whoever puts the content up there. So the fact that, for instance, the ECB, I was watching earlier today a live stream of the 2005 Edgbaston test that the ECB were doing on their YouTube channel, and the fact that they are able to put that up and get money back and actually monetize the content that way, and the ICC also are putting a whole lot of content up as well, I think is really a step in the right direction. But you do worry that a lot of that content came when it was originally being broadcast on public service broadcasters, and now that Sky and the like have got involved, that may you know, significantly change things. So you're right, that is a deep delve in the future into the nature of cricket broadcasting rights. I'm going to give you that little bit of homework to do and come back later.
Now, you have been keeping up to date with the county scene, where obviously there's been no cricket going on, but there has been a significant appointment.
Yes, yeah, so as you say, we don't quite know what the county season is going to look like this year in the UK. Or indeed any domestic seasons across the world. One thing that caught my eye was Vikram Solanki being appointed as the head coach of Surrey. Now, Vikram Solanki is someone who was, you know, let's face it, a bit of a nilly man when it came to playing international cricket. He never won a test cap. He averaged under 30 with the bat in ODIs and T20s, and his bowling record was pretty ordinary. His county record for a long time with Worcestershire and then a short spell at the end with Surrey was hardly more spectacular. But as a captain and as an administrator, he's come to garner a lot of respect. He was president and interim chief executive of the Professional Cricketers Association and president of the Federation of International Cricketers, which I have to say wasn't something that I actually had even realized had existed before this morning. But what I think is interesting about him, you know, having these titles with kind of ridiculous acronyms, is the fact that he's been someone who repeatedly hasn't necessarily been after glamorous roles, but has been someone who's been there and really believed in the role of having a structure and a system to really support cricket, rather than necessarily just having flash in the pan ace cricketers. So Solanki taking up one of the most prestigious roles in county cricket feels like a really positive step, actually. And in his interview that he did when he was appointed to the role, I think just this week, of the head coach of Surrey, there was one thing that particularly caught my ear, and that was that he talked about the influence of being coached by Basil D'Oliveira. And the first reason this caught my ear is I suddenly thought, wow, Vikram Solanki was coached by Basil D'Oliveira. You think of D'Oliveira being someone very much from a former age. But actually, D'Oliveira was at Worcestershire, and at the very end of his coaching time at Worcestershire would have been the very beginning of Solanki's time there as a player. So there's this kind of quite astonishing historical continuity that comes. But at the same time, I think the other thing that's quite significant is having someone like Solanki, who is so in touch with the not only the kind of lineage of the game, but also the sort of troubles of the game and the development of the game over a long period of time, I think is really significant, particularly at the moment as cricket comes to grapple with some of the issues around race, which so many other parts of the world are grappling with right at the moment. It's important to note as well that Solanki is actually the first British Asian ever to be a county head coach.
I think the point is, and I think this is starting to come out through these conversations that the sport's having about improving diversity, is that this stuff needs to be planned, and there needs to be this path for progression. And I think this is what's interesting about the fact that Solanki has already had this experience and served as a deputy coach. Because I think, you know, sometimes when you say, God, we've got to fix this, how do we instantly create this? And you think, well, actually what really matters is putting that path of progression in place, that okay, there are opportunities to be a junior coach that will then lead to be opportunities to senior, and it's having those sort of steps and opportunities in place kind of at every level. I think some sports, there's been an awful lot put on this system that's used in the American Football League, the Rooney Rule, which is this idea that clubs must interview certain ethnic minority coaches with a certain level of skills for a job. And while that's been much praised and seems to have had an impact, certainly in American football, and I think, you know, they're looking to see it can have more of an impact in UK football, sometimes those kind of solutions ignore the need to look at that kind of initial entry point into administration, that initial point. How do you get people with the skills in the first place to be able to compete for those roles?
Part watercolour, part pencil, hills in the background and a row of houses, cricketers leaping in the air. It's hard to make out what exactly is in this painting, but from the archives, and Andy is going to talk to us about The Cricket Match at Sidmouth by David Jones, painted in June 1938.
So David Jones was a poet, he was a painter, and he was also an engraver. He wrote an epic poem called In Parenthesis, which was based on his experience of the trenches in the First World War. And in its second part, the bombing officer is signing up the cricketers among the recruits for grenade practice. To quote Jones, he took the names of all those men who professed efficiency on the cricket field, more particularly those who claimed to bowl effectively. Now, Jones was not one of those. He was not a cricketer or a cricket lover. Poor little sod was his own rueful assessment of his sporting abilities.
I sometimes feel like that, to be honest.
Yes. Yes, it's a sort of a brusque, but an assessment that perhaps many of us can embrace. Now, fast forwarding a few years, and early 1936, and Jones suffers a breakdown. He was suffering delayed post-traumatic stress after his years in the trenches, and perhaps exacerbated by the strain of the work on In Parenthesis. He was losing confidence in his art, he was worried about money, anxious about the fact that he was approaching 40 with no wife, home or child, and anxious almost about the fact that he had no particular wish to have any of those things. He was also appalled by current events, by the civil war in Spain, by what was happening in Germany and the prospect of another war. As Jones would say, life is a bugger. The state of nervous inactivity would last for some years. Now, he went to Sidmouth in South Devon for sea air and recuperation in 1935, and he ended up staying on and off until 1940. It was a rather, in many ways, it was a rather British seaside life. He would read in the hotel garden, sort of wearing a coat and muffler. When the sun shone, it would give him a headache. That's very British, the moment the sun comes out. But he liked the grey days best. So the seafront empty, and in his own words, seafront empty save for a doddering general or two. Despite settling for this time at Sidmouth, he disliked the red cliffs there, saying that it was like living under a vast bulk of chocolate, that turned the bitter sea also into a cocoa lake. I have been fairly depressed and distracted, he wrote in one letter of this time. Now, the cricket match at Sidmouth is a rare triumph in this period of crippling misery and inertia. One of the most striking things about it is the angle from which it is painted. So I think generally when we think of landscape painters, we think of them out and about, you know, easel under one arm, going looking for their next scene. Now, Jones wasn't like that. To quote, I always work from the window of a house if it is at all possible. I like looking out on the world from a reasonably sheltered position. I can't paint in the wind, and I like the indoors outdoors, contained yet limitless feeling of windows and doors. So, the cricket match at Sidmouth is painted from the upstairs window of the Fort Hotel, which is where he was staying. It's a rather sort of glum, whitewashed Victorian building. I thought it was quite interesting to compare this with Eric Revilius, he of the Wisden woodcut, of the two top-hatted cricketers that we looked at back in episode 68. Now, he would sit out on a roof in rain, sleet, hail and snow, painting until his fingers were too cold to hold the brush. That's not for Jones. If he wants to capture this scene, he wants that level of comfort. But also, I think he likes the perspective, and I think you get a bit of that in the painting here.
There's something sort of quite crowded, isn't there? You know, the cricket match is only one part of the scene. And when we talked about another painting, the name of which escapes me, but the painting, the Northern painting, that we talked about a few episodes ago, where, you know, the cricket pitch was only one part of a broader landscape with, you know, chimneys in the far distance. Here you see a fence in the immediate foreground. You see something that looks almost like scaffolding just outside the window where he's sitting. You see the houses on the other side of the green. You see the hills in the distance. And so there's this kind of strange, slightly crowded sense of focus that exists there. The cricket is only one part of the scene that he's painting, almost a sort of incidental part in a way.
I think that's right. I think it is, the cricket match is at the centre, but there's so much else going on. But I think the way the cricket is portrayed is interesting. So as you said, we back in episode 116, we looked at Sam Bowles' cricket match, yep, at Edenside up in Cumbria. And there the cricketers are elegant, they're serene, but they're also pretty static. You know, white-clad figures standing stiffly. In Jones's painting, this is cricket in full flow. There's motion, confusion, argument, and
there's
play.
There are two dogs on the pitch. It is chaos, isn't it? Jones... It's difficult to know. There are birds swooping around. There is motion absolutely everywhere, isn't there? It is chaos.
I have it on good authority that Jones is a fan of dogs, and you see them regularly as a feature, and they are causing havoc here. The raised arms make you think we're midst appeal. I wonder, though, if what we might be seeing is Jones capturing many moments in a single image. Perhaps we're seeing a whole afternoon's action in one.
There's a wicketkeeper at each end. Have you seen that? It looks like there's a there's someone with pads on bending over at what might be the bowler's end. Do you see that behind the stumps?
Yes, that's a very good point.
This is someone who knows nothing about cricket, isn't it? I mean, this is someone who's looked out of the window, seen a game, started the image, come back after lunch, carried on the image when the bowling's happening from the other side without quite kind of getting it somehow, it seems.
There's too many fielders for a start. So I think that's the other thing that reinforces the fact that this must surely be kind of multiple moments. And I sometimes wonder whether we're not looking at almost, in some cases, kind of mini comic strips with one cricketer then moving into another position. You mentioned the birds, which again is a real kind of David Jones thing. He loved to paint birds in flight and birds sort of blown around by the wind. And you have this rather nice thing here where you've got the birds kind of tumbling and swooping in the sky and then the players in chaos below. And they kind of mirror each other. It's sort of, you know, birds at play, cricketers at play below. But as you say, the players themselves here are not the entire story at all. And the interesting thing is that if you actually look at the foreground, David Jones has spent much more time and effort on the spectators than he
They're
has
coloured
on the
players. They're coloured in much more, aren't they?
You know, they are.
I mean, literally coloured in characterfully coloured in.
Well, this is exactly it, because it's a funny thing. It's drawn in pencil and then coloured in watercolour. But you're right to say that the players themselves, I guess partly because they're in their whites, Jones hasn't bothered. They're not really given colouring. I mean, okay, there's perhaps the odd cap, but it's the crowd who are given the real attention. We have some sort of major general figure in some sort of tweed wandering along, stick under his arm. I've got a couple of favourites. There's a man for whom the excitement has got all too much at the back of the stand and appears to have nodded off. But there's also a blue-coated man with, I think, his son wandering along the boundary. And the son appears to have raised his arm in sheer excitement.
Appealing along with the players.
Cricket next to him. Exactly, getting as carried along by then. One thing I have absolutely not been able to solve, and we would welcome any viewers' suggestions on this, is where the cricket ball itself is. I should say that this feature deserves a considerable. My wife Laura deserves a considerable research credit here for having provided most of the brain power behind this week's From the Archives. She thought perhaps the ball could be found in near the hotel, but actually looking at it again, we thought that was actually part of the building itself. So,
but it's,
yes, if anyone can track the
but
ball
it's part
down,
of the kind of the joy of it, that it's not a that it's an impressionistic scene, that it isn't literal in any way, that it gives you a sense of what a village green and the excitement and the color and the scenes going on, and therefore the fact that there are too many players and the fact that there appear to be two wicketkeepers and there doesn't appear to be a ball is all sort of part and parcel of that experience almost.
I think that's right. It's the sort of the fun of the occasion, and it's also a very British scene somehow. I mean, you have quite literally a very British emblem in the Union Jack fluttering in the top left of the painting. You've then got these kind of grand but slightly faded seaside hotels that I think are familiar to so many of us who've spent any time near the British coast. And then the kind of rolling hills in the background. Curiously, there's also, I mean, you can find an awful lot here. There's also a rogue cannon in the left-hand side of the painting, which also somehow kind of harks back to, I don't know, British history of sorts.
I thought that was a wheelbarrow for a moment, but you're quite right. It is a cannon, isn't it?
Encouragingly, it's facing away rather than towards the field. So make of that what you will. The work is in a private collection now, and Jones is going through a real resurgence at the moment. He's sort of much loved, and I think people are really rediscovering some of his successes, but this is not one of his most famous works. But I think what I really love about it is it's proof of how an artist who at this time was, I think in many ways unhappy, really struggling for inspiration, found that inspiration in a game that he knew absolutely nothing about. To the review, and for this episode, we've been reading The Great Romantic, Cricket and the Golden Age of Neville Cardus by Duncan Hamilton. It was published in July last year. Now, Duncan Hamilton was a journalist in Nottingham and Leeds for 32 years. He has won the William Hill Sports Book of the Year on 3 occasions, the only writer to do so, including for this book. And we've previously reviewed his biography of Harold Larwood here, as well as The Last English Summer. It's part a biography of Neville Cardus, but it's also part a series of profiles of the great players of that era. Now, Cardus's reputation is pretty unparalleled in the game, but what is it about Cardus's writing that Hamilton believes was so revolutionary?
Quite early on in the book, Hamilton sets out the shift that Cardus created in cricket writing from something that was essentially reportage, something that was, you know, effectively a setting out of scorecards, what happened on a particular day, towards something that was storytelling, something that you could hear and see and smell through the writing as if you were there. And one of the points that Hamilton makes at one point, which I think is really obvious but definitely worth worth repeating, is the fact that without television and without radio, it was only through words that people could actually come to appreciate cricket, and that Cardus was first and foremost a wordsmith. He was a lover of cricket, but he was also a wordsmith, and that was the great revolution that he brought about in cricket writing, was the ability for cricket writing effectively to be literary.
And as you say, I mean, not only no TV, but in many of the papers of the day, you know, no photos often, you know, no images even. A lot of this idea, I think, of treating cricketers as characters. So Hamilton talks about this idea of treating them as like figures in a play or from a novel. And I think the Cardus Emmett Robinson issue, it gives a nice image of this. There's this idea that Robinson once said to Cardus that he'd made him up, making the point that Cardus's characterization of Robinson really created Robinson as a character, as a figure in the press. And you then have this fascinating thing that Robinson then apparently played up to this more. His fidgety mannerisms and idiosyncrasies became more pronounced. So you have this kind of fascinating cycle of a player being described, perhaps over-described, and then living up to that description. It gives you a sense of Cardus's power.
And also the thing that gives you a sense of his power is that Robinson was not someone, I think, who we would otherwise know about or who would otherwise be known unless Cardus had chosen to write about him and to champion him. He's not someone who's got extraordinary statistics. And in that sense, Cardus was creating the cricketing legacy and deciding who it was that would go on to have a legacy, you know, in the game as well.
But Cardus absolutely worshipped the greats, but he also didn't rely on statistics, did he? He absolutely believed there were figures who deserved to be remembered who didn't have the great statistics.
Yep, exactly.
As part of that, there's a feeling that his legacy has at times been slightly tainted by what if you're being generous, you call poetic license. What if you're being critical, you call making stuff up. And Cardus was honest about this. I mean, he talks about feeling that characters in cricket were not always communicative enough. They didn't say the right things. I thought something must be done about this. He was transparent about this. Hamilton does acknowledge this and sort of ends up, I think, very much defending Cardus, basically making the case that what he lost as a reporter, he more than gained as a sort of great writer about the game. But I suppose it's probably fair to acknowledge that others may not be as generous in as Hamilton.
And repeatedly, Cardus is shown to have a certain level of disdain for statistics, for the idea that his reports in newspapers are there only as a record of historically what happened, and that actually what he sees his role as a cricket writer to be, and again it's something that he repeatedly states and Hamilton repeatedly reiterates, is to describe those moments of astonishing beauty. It's not about the any man who can go out and score 200 because they happen to get a whole lot of inside edges. It's about Jack Hobbs playing a cover drive that is so beautiful and needs to be described in that particular moment. That is what cricket is, I think, for Cardus. So this entire construct is one great cricket writer writing about another great cricket writer. Do you feel that the book works?
I think it does. I worried early on that Hamilton was overquoting Cardus, which can feel a little bit like a sort of cop-out, right? If you're dealing with one of the great writers of all time, cricket writers of all time, to just endlessly quote them feels a little bit like, it feels too easy. But I think and also it begs the question, well, why not just read that writer rather than read lots of quotes by him? But I think as I got into the book, I started to realise that he's actually quoting very judiciously. It's either to make a particular point about Cardus's writing, or even then to start building these almost co-written profiles of players. So you have Cardus writing something which Hamilton builds on. And there's particularly this moment where Hamilton describes one player as having kind of sticking like a barnacle, and you think, God, this is Hamilton, whether consciously or unconsciously, very much playing Cardus. You know, he's very naturally following in his footsteps.
I think the other thing about the kind of affinity between the writers, and you sort of mentioned this earlier, is that you do repeatedly feel that Hamilton is on Cardus's side. You know, it's set up from the very beginning of the book. Hamilton is clear that Cardus is something of an idol of his. They talk about the personal connection via John Arlott that they have with one another. Mm. And one thing that I think comes across quite effectively is the way that Hamilton, through that, treats the eccentricities, let's say, of Cardus's life. You know, because Cardus was, as a man, a pretty weird person, to be honest. You know, so someone who in a way is a bit of a caricature of a early 20th century male, someone who had a wife that he didn't have sexual relationships with but had multiple flings. He also, I think more interestingly, is the story of his repeatedly falling in and out of love with cricket, how he starts off with this, you know, this boy who in Lancashire is falling in love with the game, but then has periods where he hates the establishment at Lord's, where he thinks that cricket isn't worthy of writing about compared to classical music. And there's something very kind of steady-handed and clear-eyed about the way that Hamilton guides us through this kind of very, very topsy-turvy relationship that Cardus has with the game, which is difficult to know what to make of sometimes.
I just wondered, I mean, there was so much in this book that I learnt, but it was one of the most striking things to me was that exact period you're describing about when he fell out of love with the game, particularly in his 40s, I think. And it struck me as this kind of midlife crisis of sorts, this sense of, yep, God, I've dedicated so much of my life to covering this thing. But the interesting thing is, it was also combined with this really serious nostalgia as well. He basically was just obsessed with the fact that the game wasn't what it was. And I just wonder, you know, I just wonder how typical that is. Maybe an awful lot of sports writers have that moment where they think, God, I've seen it at its best.
But yet also spent a lot of his time lambasting those who got doughy-eyed about the past and said how it wasn't what it was compared to what it was now. You know, someone who also was willing to, and this again, these extraordinary moments that I hadn't quite realized about how when Cardus came to Australia and was feted as an absolute hero, you know, here was someone who was a household name because of his cricket writing, which I just found a kind of astonishing in a way, because that is a sign of what the power of journalism was, let alone what the power of Cardus was at the same time. And so I think the book
was, he didn't know, did he? He came to Australia not knowing that he was so famous, which I think again is quite hard today to get your head around, the idea that you would be surprised, you'd turn up, be like, oh God, I'm quite big here.
And then Ditto how he came to square that on not to square that with the idea that at Lords no one wanted to know about him, you know, and that people like, you know, Plum Warner just didn't really think that he was a part of the establishment or should be considered a part of the establishment, and he was relegated to being an associate member of the MCC rather than a full member of the MCC, and all of these kind of different cognitive dissonances of someone who, you know, proudly proclaimed in his memoirs that he was the son of a prostitute and yet wanted to be the member of an exclusive London club that bought into all of these, you know, social niceties, all of these kind of contradictions that come to bear.
And that was the 126th episode of Reverse Rep Radio. Thank you very much for joining us. We very much hope that the next time we record, we will have some actual, real, live cricket to talk about.